Hello and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Sunday, May 17th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. Riceville cattlemen advocate for free marketing system. Bob and Jane Noble have fed cattle west of Riceville since the early 1980s. Noble, who has raised cattle since he was a youth in 4-H, was recently elected to the position of president-elect of the Iowa Cattlemen's Association, and in December 2021, he will become the president of the organization. Being an independent cattle feeder, he is passionate about providing independent cattlemen with access to a free marketing system. Noble believes with only a few major packing companies in the U.S., many independent cattle feeders currently are being unfairly treated in the marketplace. He said the current situation with the COVID-19 has lowered live cattle prices while prices in meat counters have risen. Cattlemen are receiving bids of around $120 per hundredweight on live cattle when the crisis first surfaced, Noble said. Then live cattle prices slid down to about $105 per hundredweight as time progressed. But the price of processed beef in the grocery store skyrocketed. Beef futures for June delivery actually slid below $80 per hundredweight for a time. The disparity was so bad that Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley has asked for an investigation into the current marketing of beef. Beef packers are now facing issues of possible plant closings and transitioning from processing meat for fast food and other restaurants to processing meats for home consumption. Despite these problems, Noble and other independent producers believe the crisis has provided an opportunity for major packers to gain an unfair advantage in the marketplace. Noble said independent cattle producers in the Midwest have long been a part of a marketing system called True Price Discovery Marketing. Through the marketing practice, beef producers have exercised the right to contact several packing company buyers for bids on their cattle and then compare pricing when marketing their fat cattle. Under the system, packing companies compete to buy a producer's cattle. True pricing discovery has been a part of the cattle industry for many decades. The true pricing discovery system began to be challenged when larger commercial feedlots were established in the southern and southwestern parts of the U.S. With the very large commercial feeding operations in place, packing companies began developing marketing agreements with those commercial operations. Today, commercial lots market hundreds of thousands of cattle each year and make up about 80% of the beef produced in the U.S. This type of marketing is called captive supply. Because packers have ready access to a large number of fat cattle at all times, they can then pressure smaller independent producers to sell cattle on their terms. Like the swine and poultry industries, smaller producers can be squeezed out of a place to market their livestock. Noble said that because Iowa and eastern Nebraska still have a large number of independent beef producers, cattlemen associations are beginning to join with the Iowa Cattlemen's Association to promote legislation so that the true price discovery system can continue to be a part of the beef industry's open market system. We are building with other state associations to form a new kind of coalition so we can go to legislators in Washington seeking legislation so we can protect our right to negotiate for our selling prices, said Noble. Looking at today's economics in the beef industry, Noble said, one of our problems is we are now killing more cattle than we did 2 or 3 years ago, but we now are starting a liquidation phase in the cattle supply. Numbers are beginning to go down, and cattlemen are not keeping heifers. Because cattle's reproductive and production cycles are much longer than hogs or poultry, it takes a much longer time to downsize the industry to where producers can make reasonable profit. Capturing the coronavirus pandemic in real time for all time. Hand sanitizer, toilet paper rolls, face masks, they're all part of a future exhibit of the impact of the coronavirus on Iowa and how Iowans coped with the pandemic. But documenting the deadly disease is not just for the future. The State Historical Society of Iowa already is documenting coronavirus in real time. We have a long history of documenting the lives and experiences of Iowans, and we actually have a pretty good tradition when it comes to the most relevant experiences of collecting in real time, said Leo Landis, curator for the Historical Society's museum, who is guiding the collection of materials for that future coronavirus exhibit. Recognizing the significance of what was happening, Landis went up the hill from the Des Moines Museum the day in March when the Iowa legislature suspended its session to help stop the spread of COVID-19 to shoot photos of the health screening tent outside the Capitol. "I knew that, hey, this is day one of things being different," he said. The Society has been collecting the history of Iowa and Iowans since 1857, through war and peace, floods and droughts, depressions, recessions, waves of immigrations, and more, said Landis, who grew up in Clive and earned a bachelor's degree in history at Iowa State University. He has a master's in museum studies from Eastern Iowa University and has done work on PhD in ag and rural history at ISU. A museum curator for about 20 years, he has been with the State Historical Society of Iowa since 2013. To capture the stories of this time, the Historical Society is inviting Iowans to submit materials that can help future generations understand the pandemic and its impact across the state. Question: what is it that you're asking Iowans to contribute? Empty hand sanitizer bottles and empty toilet paper rolls? Answer: we don't need 200 selfies of people with masks, Landis said, but photos of a Mother's Day gathering with everyone masked or other events that were shaped by COVID-19 are examples of the type of artifacts the museum is looking for to help preserve the stories. At this time, the Society is accepting digital submissions, photos, emails, videos, blogs, and more, as well as suggestions about physical artifacts that could be donated at a later time when the Society's facilities reopen to the public. Question: isn't the official record of the pandemic being documented through the official records of actions of state government, the governor's office, Department of Public Health, and other state agencies? Answer: yes, but we also want to gather the stories of Iowans in real time. The journals and diaries or photographs that are being taken or recorded now are important for us as well. The Society is particularly interested in stories and materials that reflect the pandemic's ripple effects on healthcare, education, and labor. It's looking for stories from Iowans about how the pandemic has affected their everyday lives, including social distancing, working from home, and shifting school and other activities to virtual formats. Question: aren't you worried that you will be flooded with face masks and some of the more mundane artifacts of the pandemic? Answer: I would say no. If you say, is a dozen homemade masks enough? I would probably say yes, as long as the cultural, ethnic, and geographic diversity of the state is represented. We want to make sure we get the stories of all Iowans, whether it's Latino ancestry, African American ancestry, European ancestry. We are the holders of the state's history. That's our role and mission. We will do our best to preserve and share your story to future Iowans. We take it seriously. Question: we joke about hand sanitizer and toilet paper, but what else do you hope Iowans will share? Answer: we would appreciate hearing of stories from people that are working in different processing plants or wherever they are working. If you are an Iowan and it's a story that tells about your experience, we want to hear it. We know that the stories are going to be compelling, but especially if you've got a journal that you've been keeping, an individual account of someone's experience in the coronavirus pandemic of 2020 would be something we'd certainly be interested. Question: what will happen to the materials you gather? Answer: one of the things I always tell people who donate things to the museum collection is that as soon as we have processed it and photographed it, it's available virtually for anyone with computer access. Question: when will these materials be on display in the museum as part of an exhibit for the public to see? Answer: I think in 5 to 10 years, as we have some distance and can step away from that first draft of history. In 5 to 10 years, I see these being stories that Iowans will want to have a better understanding of how our state fared and addressed and persevered through this time. 10 years is about half of a generation. So by 2030, I think there will be a story that we can have some distance and perspective on. Balsleys carry on the beef tradition. Brad Balsley is a third-generation farmer who has helped keep the family's cattle business thriving. We live on the family farm that I grew up on, said Balsley, who with his wife Jill farms south of Orchard. Brad and Jill both attended and graduated from Osage High School and were married in 1978. In the early 1980s, the couple began farming the family farm where they raised their two sons, Derek and Dustin. My grandfather Dennis began farming here in 1923, and my dad AJ took over from him, Balsley said. My dad and granddad were always in the cattle business, but they didn't have as many cattle as there are around here now. When I began farming, I was a full-time carpenter and part-time farmer, but I sold the construction company 3 years ago because I have plenty to do around here. Balsley began his venture into the cattle business through a cow-calf herd. He said he began by buying some cows and kept adding to them. Later, he took over his dad's herd of cows, he said. We still have our cow herd, and most of the calves are fed out, but we do sort out about one-third of the heifers and keep them for our replacements or sell them for breeding heifers, he said. I do my own AI breeding and also use a cleanup bull. Over the past 10 years, I've settled mostly on an Angus breeding program. Balsley said they have done a lot of pasture improvement for the herd over the years. We rotate our pastures where we split a pasture into four or five paddocks, he said. We graze one paddock down and then rotate the cows into the next paddock. We do fertilize our pasture land with manure and add a little nitrogen in the spring. We calf in April, which is a very busy time. Then we wean our calves at the end of September or on the first part of October. We get our calves started on creep feed before we wean. We want them to be used to eating hard feed so they aren't so stressed when we wean them. We want to keep the calves happy and healthy when they are weaned. Balsley keeps records on each cow and culls them if they don't rebred, have a bad attitude, get too old, or fail to raise a good calf. The calves raised on the farm are only a small percentage of the cattle that the Balsleys feed out. They began purchasing larger groups of feeder cattle after Brad began feeding distillers grain, and later they built a large monoslope cattle building. Most of the cattle arrive on the farm weighing between 700 and 800 pounds and are marketed between 1450 and 1500 pounds. We start our feeder cattle on a ration of corn silage, ground hay, earlage, distiller's grain, and a commercial balancer made up of vitamins and minerals, he said. We use six different rations, and those rations are around 14% protein. The closer the cattle get to market, the more energy is in their rations. I am disappointed if our cattle don't gain around 4 pounds per day. Balsley's monoslope shed has a concrete floor, and Brad lays down a thin coat of lime to prevent disease, then beds it over it with bean or corn stalks. He said the comfort of the livestock is important, but bedding takes a lot of time. My granddad used to say, cattle that are well bed are half fed, said Balsley, who has instilled large overhead fans in the shed to keep the cattle comfortable and to cut down on roof condensation. Balsley erected a 600-bale shed to keep hay and bedding from the weather, which provides higher quality feed. He also built a silage defacer, which prevents less feed spoilage in the bunker silo. A director for the 5th District of the Iowa Cattlemen Association, Balsley said, I think it's really important to join the association, which is our only voice in Washington and on the state level. I think it is important to be involved in it. Asked what has been the biggest change in cattle feeding over the years, Balsley replied, genetics has changed phenomenally, and distiller's grain has had a big impact on how we feed cattle today. Timber and pasture play important roles in Oswald operation. When it comes to the cattle business, Randy Oswald is a chip off the old block. I've been doing this for about 25 years. I guess I have always been like my dad, Andy, and my granddad, Leo, who raised cattle, who with his wife, Patty, farms and raises cattle north of Fertile. I was born around cattle, and that is what I like. Oswald said their timbered pasture is an essential part of their cow-calf operation. The timber provides their cattle with the natural cover of fallen logs and scrubs, and the unique topography of the timbered pasture also provides several steep, sloped areas, which provides protection from weather. A pond dug by Randy's granddad, Leo, provides water for the cattle. We start calving in the timber around April 1st and calf for about 90 days, Oswald said. We have pretty good protection in the timber, but we can have some weather problems, so we have a shed and a calving pen if it's needed. Oswald said with normal spring weather patterns, their system works well. After calving, the Oswalds turn their cow and calf pairs into several pastures around May 15th. The pairs will be kept on grass throughout the summer and into the fall. One of the major jobs during the summer is keeping up fences. One precaution that Randy uses is separate solar-powered electric fencers for gaps where there is a waterway. If a creek fence is taken out by floating debris or high water, the rest of the electrical fence keeps functioning. We creep feed our calves oats and wean them around Thanksgiving. The weaned calves weigh around 450 to 500 pounds, Oswald said. I use the Green Tag program where calves have to be castrated and dehorned before they can be certified. The veterinarian vaccinates and implants them about 2 weeks before weaning. These calves must be free of all internal and external parasites. They are then green tagged in the upper left ear. This certification accompanies the calves and adds value to our feeder calves when they are sold. I have a small feedlot where I background our calves during the winter. I bunk feed them grass hay and corn silage and top dress with a 40% protein. I usually feed them about 115 days. We feed them over winter and usually sell them in mid-March as feeders weighing around 700 pounds. Because of the coronavirus, we weren't able to sell our feeders at a special feeder auction in Algona this year. We still have our yearlings, which weigh around 800 pounds. In caring for the cow herd, Oswald has a portion of their cows AI bred and also uses their Hereford and Angus bulls as sires. Cows are culled if they lose a calf, fail to breed, have poor temperament, or have a poor udder. The culls are replaced with homegrown heifers. I run our cows in the corn stalks as much as possible during the winter, but oftentimes snow cover creates problems, Oswald said. I use a vertical feed mixer to mix corn silage and ground hay, then feed the cows out in the open pasture. I also have mineral feeders for the herd. Patty, who is a recent retiree from the USDA office in Mason City, also plays a role in everyday operations. I help check cows and build fence, she said. I care for a large garden, do a lot of canning, and care for our horses, while Randy does most of the cattle work. I like helping with the cattle. I was raised on a farm where there was always livestock, and I have always enjoyed this. Scott Neese helps beef industry focus on a safer product. Scott and Julie Neese have fed cattle on their farm east of Osage since 1990. Scott, who grew up on a farm, has been involved in beef promotion since 2005. Previously, he has served both as president and treasurer of the Mitchell County Cattlemen's Association and as president of the Iowa Cattlemen's Association. Neese begins serving as a director on the National Federation of Beef Council in 2010. Currently, he serves on the organization's Beef Safety Committee, which he had previously co-chaired. The committee oversees the funds that are collected from the cattle producers' national mandatory dollar per head checkoff. My committee suggests programs where that money can go, Neese said. One of the programs we suggested funding was to ensure the correct stewardship in the use of antibiotics. We want to make sure cattle producers are using antibiotics correctly. We don't want producers bringing cattle into processing plants with antibiotic residue. Contrary to many consumers' beliefs, there is zero tolerance for antibiotics of any kind in meat or milk. When antibiotics first came out in the feed industry, sometimes they were used for growth promotion, but the usage of antibiotics in livestock production has dropped dramatically since then. Neese, who stated that if a USDA inspector finds antibiotic residue in any meat or milk brought into processing plants, there will be a stiff penalty imposed. If a producer sees an animal that is not feeling well, he should call his veterinarian and have him or her come and view the animal, he said. The vet and the beef producer needs to come up with a treatment plan so the producer can follow the proper protocol before marketing the animal. All animals must be off antibiotics at least 30 days before they can be taken to market. We are trying to use a common sense approach to protect the public, which just makes good business sense. Beef producers have to obtain a prescription from their veterinarian before they can even feed antibiotics to their cattle. The program involves nationwide symposiums that bring cattle producers and medical doctors together. The meetings are structured so those in the medical field can have a better understanding of the protections and laws that cattlemen have to follow. The meetings help medical officials see there are strict regulations in place to keep antibiotics from entering the food chain. Another issue that Neese's committee has helped fund is the Beef Quality Assurance Program, or BQA, which has been requested by major packing companies. Under the program's guidelines, individual cattle feeders and truckers have to go through a certification process. The certification helps consumers know that cattle are being treated humanely while on the farm and while being transported. The program was created so consumers know they are getting a high-quality and enjoyable product, said Niece, who stated that if a cattle producer isn't certified, packing companies often refuse to buy the producer's cattle. The committee has also approved funding for a program to help rid packing facilities of E. coli problems that can occur during the harvesting of beef. All beef animals naturally carry a certain amount of E. coli bacteria on their hide and hoofs. The key to the protection program is to cooperate with harvesting facilities to help identify and eliminate any practices that might potentially allow that E. coli to spread to a meat product. For me, it has been a privilege and honor to serve the beef industry in these roles at the local, state, and national levels, said Niece. Mason City Noon Lions Club turns 100, one of the oldest in the nation. On May 12th, the Mason City Noon Lions Club became one of the first Lions Clubs in the nation to celebrate its 100th anniversary. Its motto is, "We Serve." "I wanted to help out in the community," said Mara Linsky, Vice President and Program Chair of the Mason City Noon Lions Club. "The Lions is all about service, and so I thought it would be a nice club to join to get out there and do some volunteer work and be active in the community." While the club provides members with many community service opportunities, the club's primary focus is on vision. In 1925, Helen Keller called upon Lions Club International to take action by helping individuals with vision and hearing problems, and the organization graciously accepted the challenge. Each year, starting in the fall, Noon Lions Club members conduct eye screenings for children 5 and under. Children under the age of 5 cannot report a vision problem, so the club visits daycares and preschools throughout the area to take pictures of their eyes. These images are then sent to the University of Iowa Hospital for them to determine if the child needs follow-up care. According to Dennis Riedel, a member since 1993 and current club president, in the last 18 years, his club has screened 8,500 children. The club works to support those in the community who cannot afford to get tested for or purchase glasses or hearing aids. They also collect used glasses to be recycled into new ones for those in need internationally. Although the club started with 47 members in 1920 and has declined to the current 26 members, they still stand strong throughout many other service projects. In the many years of the club's history, they have participated in community kitchens and Meals on Wheels, as well as donating to various programs. Members of the club have also made efforts to promote diabetes awareness and environmental issues. Another one of their annual events is a tailgate chili supper fundraiser held at the Mason City Mohawks' last home football game. This event was first held in 1992 and has been held every year since. Since the club started, weekly meetings have been held on Wednesdays at noon, but they have been on hold due to the pandemic. As a result, the centennial celebration has been postponed until further notice. Celebrations. 50th Wedding Anniversary. Richard and Mary Schrader Squire are celebrating their 50th anniversary after being married on May 23, 1970. Cards and wishes can be sent to 836 15th Street Southeast, Mason City, Iowa, 50401. No gifts, please. Having a party to celebrate this occasion with family and friends at a later date on Sunday, July 5th at Charles McNider Art Museum, 1 to 4 p.m., when it is safe to gather in groups again. Salute. Congratulations to Laura Gobelli. Congratulations to Laura Gobelli, MSN. Laura was voted one of the Houston Chronicle's top nurses in honor of National Nurses Week. Laura has been a nurse in Houston, Texas at Memorial Hermann Health System for 35 years. Laura is formerly from Mason City. Thanks. Thank you to all of my friends and family for making my retirement and birthday two very special days. I appreciate all the cards and good wishes. Signed, Larry Merchant. Birthdays. William Bill Allman, 97. William Bill Allman turned 97 years young on May 14th. Please help us celebrate his birthday by sending cards and wishes to Sheffield Care Center, 100 Bennett Drive, Sheffield, Iowa, 50475. Happy birthday, Dad, with love from your family. Birthdays, Martin Meyer, 90. Martin Meyer will celebrate his 90th birthday on Tuesday, May 19th. Birthday greetings may be sent to him at 515 Main Street, Swaledale, Iowa, 50477. Happy birthday, with love from your family. Guest columnist Sharon Randall. Being wrong leads to feeling all right. Sometimes it's good to be wrong. I should know. I am wrong a lot. Ask my husband. He loves to correct me. It's not his most attractive quality, but it proves helpful on occasion. Before I tell you the following story, I want to be clear. I am fine, thank you. As fine as I ever get, but I was not fine yesterday. Have you ever thought you were dying? I don't mean someday, I mean now. It's a sobering experience. It can make you see more clearly what matters and what you might do differently if given another chance. When I was 8, my dad rented out the pasture to a neighbor's bull and warned me not to go near it. Back then, I had a tendency to do as I pleased. I still do. But when I climbed over that fence and saw that bull coming for me, I had only one thought. Run, fool! That was long ago. I've since had a lifetime of practice as a daughter, a wife, a mother, a friend, praying for strength, caring for loved ones, calming fears, facing dangers head on. Now it seemed it was time for me to do those things for myself. Here's how it all began. Like many of us, my husband has been reading quite a bit about the coronavirus, how to avoid it, and identify symptoms and early warning signs. So he ordered a pulse oximeter, a clothespin-like gadget you clamp on your finger to measure your pulse rate and the level of oxygen in your blood. It arrived yesterday. He tried it first and his rates were normal. I was busy playing Freecell and told him I'd try it later. When he went out to the garage, I clamped the gadget on my finger and read the results, certain they'd be fine. They weren't. I tried it again and again. My oxygen level seemed so low that, according to one website, I needed to go straight to the emergency room. For a moment, I pictured a bull galloping across a pasture. But I told myself I'd been sitting too long, not breathing enough, just needed some exercise. So I got on a treadmill for 20 minutes, then checked the numbers again. Still too low. I didn't dare tell my husband. I didn't want to alarm him or, worse, have him take charge. Instead, I made a plan. First, I'd shower, wash my hair, do my makeup, and pack my essentials. If I didn't make it through the day, at least I'd have clean hair and a charger for my phone. Then I would tell my husband I love him and that thanks to the stupid gadget he ordered, I was planning to drive to the ER alone without him or my kids because I didn't want to risk exposing them to the virus. That's when it hit me. I might never see my loved ones again. Several long moments and a quick prayer later, when I finally told my husband the plan, his eyes got as big as hubcaps. "Wait," he said, "what was the reading on the oximeter?" So I told him. And he looked at me the way he always does when I say something crazy. Suddenly, we both saw it. I was wrong. I had misread the numbers. The lesser number was my pulse rate. The larger number was my oxygen level. And both were perfectly fine. I felt like I had just jumped a barbed wire fence and left a bull snorting on the other side. Instead of going to the ER, I spent the day being thankful. Thankful to be alive, to be relatively healthy, to be home even under quarantine and not in a hospital, to have loved ones who always laugh at my mistakes and are glad that I'm still here, and to look forward to waking up tomorrow, come what may, just to see what happens next. I hope you and yours are thankful for those things too. There are worse things in life than being wrong, even if you're being chased by a bull. You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Sunday, May 17th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. James M. Blanchard, born February 28, 1939, died May 13, 2020. James Michael Jiggs Blanchard passed away peacefully at his home in Rockport, Texas, with his loving wife, Kathy, at his side. He fought a long, courageous battle with cancer the past 8 years. Jim, Jiggs to his family and old friends, was born February 28, 1939 in Mason City to parents Clovis and Delvina Suave Blanchard. Jim attended St. Joseph Catholic School through the 10th grade. In the summer of 1955, he took a job on a farm in Ventura. Because of his strong work ethic, the couple asked him to stay, and for the next 2 years, he worked and went to school in Ventura. He was proud to be a VHS graduate of the class of 1957, where many lifelong friendships were made. In June 1957, Jim enlisted in the USMC. He spent most of the next 3 years as a radio operator in the Philippines. He was honorably discharged on June 19, 1960. Upon discharge, he returned home to Mason City. He worked at Weaver White Grocery Warehouse and Holiday Erickson Gas Station until 1961, when he went to work for State Brand Creamery. He was proud to be a two-time Blue Ribbon butter maker while there. In October 1962, he married Jerry Ann Johnson of Rockwell. Two children were born to this union, Brent and Blake. Their marriage ended after 10 years. In 1966, Jim went to work for Industrial Services Company as their first millwright. On March 22, 1975, he married Kathy Henriksen at Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Winnebago, Minnesota. They honeymooned in Rockport, Texas, and Hawaii. The next 7 years, Jim and Kathy traveled in their fifth wheel from job site to job site. In winters, they would head back to Rockport, Texas for fishing. Jim continued to work for Industrial Services until 1976. It was then he went to work solely for the Ken Bratney Company in Des Moines for the next 30 years, having a total of 40 years with the greatest boss, Ken Bratney. He traveled the U.S. and the world supervising the construction of seed processing plants and making many more lifelong friends along the way. Jim retired in 2010, and he and Kathy moved to their home in Rockport. Jim's greatest love was his family. There was nothing he would not do for them. He treasured the time spent hunting and fishing with his sons. Family reunions, cooking ribs or shrimp, baking cookies to share, golf and cribbage all brought him joy. His greatest joy, though, were his grandchildren, Chad and Nicole. He was so proud of each of them and loved them with all his heart. Jim is survived by his wife of 45 years, Kathy, son Brent and daughter-in-law Teresa of Rockwell, grandson Chad and granddaughter Nicole, both of Rockwell, sisters Jerry Kolwinska of Rockwell, Texas, and June Blanchard of Mason City, brother Bill Blanchard of Manly, sisters-in-law Carol Blanchard of Montrose, Colorado, Dee Henriksen of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, brothers-in-law Dennis and Joe Henriksen of Wayzata, Minnesota, Stephen and Renata Henriksen of Longville, Minnesota, 28 nephews and nieces, 54 great-nephews and nieces, and 27 great-great-nephews and nieces, along with many friends. Jim was preceded in death by his parents, Clovis and Delvina, son, Blake, in 2002, his younger brothers, Chuck and Paul, mother and father-in-law, Vivian Henriksen Paulson, Eldor Henriksen and Clifford Paulson, brothers-in-law Ernie Kolwinska and Gary Henriksen, and sisters-in-law Jeanette and Arlene Blanchard. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, a celebration of Jim's life will be held in Rockport and Clear Lake at a later date. Online condolences can be made at charliemarshallfuneralhomes.com, and Charlie is spelled C-H-A-R-L-I-E, and Marshall has two L's, M-A-R-S-H-A-L-L. June M. Frederickson, born June 26, 1923, died May 14, 2020. June M. Frederickson, 96, of Mason City, passed away peacefully at home on May 14th with her family at her side. The memorial celebration of life will be postponed to be announced later. She will rest with her husband at Elmwood St. Joseph Cemetery in Mason City. Online condolences may be left for the family at majorericksonfuneralhome.com, and Erickson is spelled E-R-I-C-K-S-O-N. June Maxine Frederickson was born in Rock Falls to William E. and Gladys Tibbetts on June 26, 1923. June married the love of her life, Neeland B. Frederickson, on May 17, 1944. They were married 65 years until his death on January 4, 2009. Junie loved singing and dancing at her family gatherings and fishing bullheads in the local rivers and lakes. Her favorite place to fish was up north on Minnesota lakes with friends and family. She was known to many for her love of bingo and occasional trip to the casino to play nickel slots with her sister Betty Lane. She kept a yodel in her heart and was loved by many and will be greatly missed. June was a beloved mother, wife, sister, daughter, grandmother, great-grandmother, aunt, and friend. June is survived by her four children, Terry N. Fredrickson, Kenneth D. Fredrickson, Lori L. Nessler, and Martin D. Fredrickson. She is lovingly remembered by her four grandchildren, Sean J. Gage and Casey L. Nessler, children of Lori and Ray Nessler, Tiffany J. Lee, daughter of Terry and Vicki Fredrickson, and Lauren M. Canoy, daughter of Martin and Grace Fredrickson. Great-grandma was the most fun grandma to Taylor J. Lee and Brittany E. Lee, daughters of Tiffany and Andrew Lee, and James D. and Charlie A. Canoy, children of Lauren and Chris Canoy. Arrangements are with Major Erickson Funeral Home and Crematory. John Skipper, guest columnist. Accountability is good medicine, necessary if tough to swallow. Silly me. Quick now, name something that you are comfortable with when it occurs to everyone else, but cringe when it applies to you. The answer, accountability. We don't mind when others are being held under a microscope, but we may be a little uneasy if we are to be evaluated by our boss, our minister, our friends, or even by other family members. In government, accountability is absolutely essential, from City Hall and the Cerro Gordo County Courthouse all the way across the country to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. And that brings me to a point that not everyone understands in this day and age. The role of the press is to hold government accountable because, if it doesn't, who will? The media doesn't always fulfill its responsibility as best it could. Mistakes are made, but the press is like pizza. Every once in a while, it leaves a bad taste in your mouth, but you don't really want to live without it, do you? The classic example of the media holding government accountable is the Watergate saga of the early 1970s, when a vigilant press exposing corruption led to the resignation of President Richard Nixon. Accountability is ever present at the local level as well. Ultimately, for elected officials, voters provide the accountability, and often they decide who to vote for on the basis of what they have read and heard about the candidates, because of the press holding politicians accountable. Many years ago, when Pete Helmstead was an anchor at KIMT-TV, he and I were working on the same story. It regarded misconduct allegations against then-Sheriff Larry Mason. He was a popular sheriff and had an excellent working relationship with the media, but now he was under fire. Helmstead and I met with Mason, who is now deceased, at his office. He denied the allegations and was upset about the publicity they were generating, particularly with an election coming up. We had some uncomfortable moments with him, and nobody left the meeting smiling. Not long afterward, Pete did his story. I did mine, and a few weeks later, Mason lost his bid for re-election. Accountability. It should be noted that no criminal charges were ever filed, and Cerro Gordo County reached an out-of-court settlement in a civil suit. The recent controversy over the possibility of the Prestige hog processing plant locating in Mason City is another example of accountability because of the public's expectations of government. The council's vote was 3-3, causing the defeat of the proposal that early on seemed like a sure thing. Mayor Bill Schickel, on the council at the time, voted against it. Mayor Eric Bookmeyer was the proposal's biggest backer. It would have been fascinating if Bookmeyer, who had been elected to two terms, had chosen to run for a third term and been opposed by Schickel, who had never been defeated in three previous runs for mayor. Accountability would have been on the front burner. Schickel ran in his most recent election on a platform of seeing the River City Renaissance Project successfully completed. He should be held accountable for that, and he knows it. That's how politics work. One of the obvious character traits of President Donald Trump is that he does not like to be held accountable, not by the press, not by the Justice Department, not by Congress, not by the Supreme Court, and not by anyone who disagrees with him. He has never been held accountable to anybody in his adult life. He has always been the boss, always calling the shots, never having to be beholden to anyone. So it's not surprising he's having trouble with accountability. It's like pizza, Mr. President. Silly me. Opinion piece from Bill Schickel, mayor of Mason City. Can we decentralize government using virtual legislating? The COVID-19 crisis has revealed many opportunities for our local, state, and federal government to better fulfill its promise of serving the people. Few things have more potential than the innovative use of technology to help with the kind of reform that is needed. The reform I am proposing would decentralize government away from Des Moines and Washington. It has the potential of returning jobs, innovation, and economic opportunity to every corner of Iowa. The Iowa legislature should immediately consider setting up what I am calling a one-day model electronic legislature. Local governments are leading the way here. Mason City, for example, has responded to the pandemic by utilizing Zoom for council meetings. Although there may be some constitutional issues that need to be addressed, there is no reason the state and federal government can't do the same thing on a trial basis, or at a minimum, launch a formal study. Senators and representatives could debate and vote electronically from their home districts. In addition to greater efficiency, it would make the legislature more accessible to local citizens, with lawmakers participating from their local library, community center, or coffee shop. Special interest groups and party insiders may fight this idea. It would make it harder to have closed-door meetings or arm-twisting in off hours. It would also be more difficult for lobbyists to corral lawmakers. Legislators could more easily focus on representing the people of their district. A bill I introduced while serving in the Iowa House in 2008, House File 2087, called for a study of the feasibility of holding a model electronic legislature in Iowa. That was 12 years ago, but with the pandemic, the idea is more timely than ever. In a book written well before the current pandemic, pollster Scott Rasmussen said the idea should also be considered on a national level. It might also be a good idea to develop a system that lets members of Congress vote from their home districts as well as in the Capitol, he wrote. You can almost picture the events around the country as representatives and senators watch major debates on the big screen with the people they are supposed to represent. Then, with the public watching and the party leaders unable to corner them, our elected politicians would cast their vote. Some in D.C. might complain that FaceTime and personal interaction are essential to the legislative process. They're right, and that's the best reason for letting politicians vote back home. It would be an improvement if representatives could have more FaceTime and interaction with the people they're supposed to represent and less time with other politicians and lobbyists. Iowans are hungry for this kind of desperately needed change. Our forefathers believed that Iowa could be a shining example of the very best that democracy has to offer. Embracing these reforms would keep their dream alive for a new generation of Iowans. J.W. Sales, guest columnist. What value do you put on a COVID-19 life? It is oftentimes said that human life is precious and priceless, a gift from God that no sublunary generated metrics can ever fully measure or value. But of course, we all are painfully aware this is not true. Everyday life is driven and measured by infinite cost-benefit and risk assessment analyses, leading into countless decision trees, all funneling toward determining the outcomes that our lives condensed down to raw numbers. Never, though, has the effect of the metric measurements of extant human existence been more apparent and colossal than our experiences during the COVID-19 pandemic. Numbers drive the focus, the time and effort applied, the resources committed, the urgency of action, the money spent, and collective community synchronicity as humans weave their ways through the most simple to the most complex decisions and deliverances of our times. Numbers alone are soulless, ideologically mute, emotionless, and amoral chattels that deliver the roadmap of life or death, often with an arrow to the human heart, and not providing for any gift of the grand reward of great treasures of everlasting life. Numbers exist only in the presence of human imagination. They have no physical existence, corporeal presence, nor do they bleed. Yet when metrics become the basis for impositions on our population and economy, as has been the case throughout the COVID-19 lockdowns, humanity is in a constant and long-term struggle determining best practices and appropriate courses of action to supplant the coronavirus devastation the United States is experiencing. We have seen and heard many analogies comparing the coronavirus crisis of today to the 1918 worldwide epidemic of Spanish flu, World War II, Pearl Harbor, 9/11, the Great Depression, and even the Civil War. Without a doubt, 2020 will be remembered as the crisis to end all crises. The impact of these past 2 months of political actions, reactions, and irreversible mandates is predicted as irremediable well beyond 50 years or more into the future. What the hell have we been doing? The cost of COVID-19 policy decisions that have so far been implemented and the dollar cost of the lockstep, suck-up sycophants of this president of the United States have delivered more irreversible damage, both physically and monetarily, than any event in history. So, what is the value of a COVID-19 life? Yours? Mine? Ours? You are in for a shocker, I guarantee you, as was I. Incontrovertible metrics advanced by corporate and governmental actuaries, high-level mathematicians, mathematical epistemologists, futurists, and prognosticators at all levels have henceforth delivered an end game of enormous real, measurable costs applicable to the COVID-19 global shutdown. Prior to COVID-19, a simple look back to federal regulatory enforcement actuaries, damage assessment institutions, and other government and quasi-government groups lead us to how life value and adequate family loss compensation computations have been arrived at over time. Making trade-offs between lives and freedoms Americans value is simply a fact of life. So when the Federal Environmental Protection Agency needed to compute the value of a life taken at Love Canal or any other environmental disaster, or the U.S. Department of Transportation had to compute the value of a life lost by an increase of legal highway speeds from 55 to 75 miles per hour, or when the Federal Department of Homeland Security was mandated to compute the value of a life of a first responder to the Twin Towers site on September 11, 2001, an officially recorded, congressionally accepted dollar value was determined and applied to an American life. Applications of a median value for an American life prior to COVID-19 lands at $9 million. As COVID-19 has overwhelmed and caused chaos in the ongoing daily American cost-benefit analyses beyond any fathomable protections, the metrics have settled into this indisputable territory. National costs of COVID-19 through May 8th from all sources, $7.5 trillion. American lives lost attributed to COVID-19, 80,000. American economic cost per COVID-19 life lost, $93,750,000. We have already lost economic power that cannot be reacquired by the end of our grandchildren's lives. COVID-19 has driven the American economy into the number two position as China surpasses us for the first time. Numbers cannot lie and neither can science. Humans alone are responsible for creating malevolent and sinister purposes from the pureness of science and mathematics. The U.S. response to COVID-19 has delivered and imposed economic suicide through our own innumeracy. Although it took only 3 months to get to this point, it may well take 30 years to regain our footing. I have acquired an extreme dislike to the term new normal. L. Dean Matheson to be inducted into Mason City Athletic Hall of Fame. There are certain names that are synonymous with the schools at which they taught or coached for decades. Bob Hilmer at Forest City, Bob Sanger at West Hancock, L. Dean Matheson at Mason City. Matheson was the head football coach of the Mohawks from 1967 to 1975, compiling a 39-33-3 overall record. He also coached two players to state championships in the discus in track and field, and in September, Matheson will be inducted as a member of the 2020 class of the Mason City Athletic Hall of Fame. I was exceedingly excited, for former Mason City discus thrower Scott Crowell said. It was fantastic to hear, much deserved. He is a fantastic person and was a wonderful coach. I was excited that he will get this honor. Matheson and Crowell shared a special moment back in April 1978 when Crowell set the national high school record in the discus with a throw of 207-8. Standing close by when Crowell set the mark was Matheson, his throws coach. He was the one I worked with all those years, Crowell said. It was the most special time. I had other state championships and Drake relays and stuff, but setting the record was by far the most enjoyable. When the moment happened, Crowell remembers the cheer that went up from the crowd as the officials went to find a measuring tape long enough to measure the record-setting throw. He was pumped and he couldn't believe it, Crowell said of Matheson. We gave each other hugs and it was just a special time overall. Tom Randall played football at Mason City under Matheson, graduating in 1974. He remembers his old coach as someone who had a lot of credibility with the players as a former college football player. Matheson played halfback for the University of Iowa and graduated in 1956, so his words carried a lot of weight. He was a likable guy, Randall said. He didn't operate out of fear. We all wanted to do exceptionally well for the coaches and our teammates. Randall, who was also a Mohawks basketball star, was a starter for just 1 year under Matheson and offensive line coach Ed Lennius, but earned a spot on the All-State first team, went on to play for Iowa State, and later the Dallas Cowboys and Houston Oilers. Randall saw some action on the field against the Pittsburgh Steelers in Super Bowl XIII, but gives credit for his football start to his coaches in Mason City. They saw something in me, Randall said of Matheson and Lennius. I didn't have any idea that I was going to be a football player. I was always a basketball player. They saw something in me, and they brought everything out of me. In addition to Matheson, Randall played basketball at Mason City for Dick Garth, also a 2020 Mason City Athletic Hall of Fame inductee. I was happy for both of them, Randall said. That was a pretty good era of Mohawk sports. The basketball teams were really good. The football teams were really good. It was a good time to be a Mohawk. Before his time as Mason City's head coach, Matheson compiled a 15-1 record in two seasons as the head football coach at Waverly, and then took over at Mason City when head coach Paul Stratham stepped down to take the athletic director position. Following his stint as the Mohawks signal caller, Matheson became the assistant principal at Roosevelt Middle School, now Lincoln Intermediate, and continued to act as an assistant coach in track and field. Matheson's replacement at Mohawk as Mohawks football coach was Barry Alvarez, who would go on to lead Mason City to a state championship in 1978. Matheson, now 86 years old, lives with his wife Norma in Mason City and was thrilled to hear the news that he would be joining the Mohawks Hall of Fame. It was great. It was something that you always hoped for, that you might get it, Matheson said. Luckily, I did, and I was overjoyed. Iowa health officials report 351 deaths, 14,651 virus cases. State health officials reported 5 more deaths and 323 additional cases of coronavirus on Sunday. The Iowa Department of Public Health said 351 people have died from COVID-19 in the state, and 14,651 have tested positive for the disease caused by the coronavirus. For some infected people, especially older adults and people with existing health problems, the virus can cause severe illness or death. But for most people, it causes mild or moderate symptoms, such as a fever and cough, that clear up in 2 to 3 weeks. Guest columnist Lowell Washburn, hitting the jackpot with a blue-winged teal sighting. One of the things I enjoy most about viewing wildlife is that you never know what's coming next. My latest example occurred while photographing wood ducks at a small wooded pond near Cerro Gordo County's Zirbal Slough. I'd been sitting in the blind for a couple of hours when a blue-winged teal came zigzagging through the canopy and loudly splashed to the water. I could tell from the bird's crescent face marking and cinnamon-speckled body that it was a drake, though I must admit that I was amazed to see the creature. The snag-studded pond is an extremely tight habitat and is hardly the kind of place you'd expect to find a blue-winged teal, a species most commonly associated with wide-open prairie marshlands. The drake was, in fact, the first and only teal I have ever seen at the pond. Nearly as soon as it landed, the bird began tipping up as it scoured the muddy bottom for seeds, snails, and emerging insect life. Eventually, the feeding duck approached my position. The teal was still tipping, which gave me an excellent view of its kicking webs. Taking aim with the camera, I was surprised by a silvery glint on the foraging duck's right leg. That glint turned out to be an aluminum U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service bird band, an important tool for scientists. Each bird band is engraved with a catalog series of personal identification numbers. When reported by hunters and others, those numbers are used by biologists to track survival, migration routes, and to pinpoint critical breeding and wintering habitats of migratory birds, including blue wings. Blue-winged teal are long-distance travelers. The majority nest in the Dakotas and Prairie Canada and spend winters in Central and South America. Although a good number of blue-winged teals are banded each year, only a very small sample of the total population is marked. Bagging a banded blue wing is an uncommon event, so much so that most hunters will never collect a single teal band in their lifetime. As I continued taking photos, the teal's feeding binge lasted for several more minutes. When the bird's appetite was finally satisfied, he hopped onto the low branch of a deadfall and began preening. Feeling refreshed and refueled, the duck returned to the water and then quickly took wing, never to be seen again. As I reviewed my photos, I couldn't help but wonder, what were the odds? By that, I mean, what were the odds that that lone teal, the one and only blue wing I've ever seen on that tiny wooded pond, would be carrying a federal bird band, and then what were the odds of that same duck showing me his leg to prove it? The word unusual just doesn't seem to do the event justice. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Sunday, May 17th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.